And we'll call the case of Ames versus the Commonwealth. Have counsel signed in?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Give me just a moment to get the machine back in place. Okay. I think we're ready when you are.
May it please the court, my name is Basil Califf. You pronounced my name correctly, and I was very impressed with that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, thank you. That was. I don't know where that inspiration came from, because I'm not always that good with
names. It's a rare occurrence.
Do you care to reserve any time for
I would that? Ask to reserve 4 minutes.
4 minutes, yes, sir.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'm here representing Robert Ames. He had three charges of which he was convicted: possession of a firearm by a nonviolent felon, possession of marijuana, and there was also a concealed weapon second offense charge against him. I have two assignments of error. The first one involves him making certain statements to the police where he says, you can't search me, don't search my car, you can't do that, things of that nature. Defense's position at trial was that was clearly an assertion of his constitutional rights, that he believed it was an unreasonable search and seizure, that it shouldn't be used as substantive evidence against him, and that it was. And I think, based on what's in the record, it appears that the judge said, hey, that's fair game. The Commonwealth can argue that if they want. Commonwealth does appear to argue that ultimately, and my position is that that is improper for somebody to have their assertion of constitutional rights used against them as substantive evidence. In my brief, I do lay out a number of other scenarios and cases that are somewhat analogous. I don't think there's a case out of Virginia that's directly on point. I couldn't find one out of another jurisdiction that was directly on point, but there were a couple of Oregon cases that seemed to follow that same line of logic, is we're going to essentially have a chilling effect on people asserting their constitutional right if
Does the fact that there was a risk, at least at the time the statements were admitted, there was a resisting charge play any role at all? Because don't they have to show that he was resisting their efforts?
I would say not. I would say that shouldn't play a role in it. I know that came up at trial, but also the Commonwealth argued after that charge had been dismissed at the motion to strike, they argue it in the closing of their case.
Well, but then it's in evidence. I mean, isn't your question the invisibility
right.
of these statements? So by the time the charge is struck, it doesn't matter. It's already in evidence, and no request was made, as best I can review the record, to then go back and take it out of evidence.
Well, I think what I said was this. It can come in for a very, very limited purpose, and that would essentially be, let's say there was a dispute about, is this his car? Does he have anything to do with this car? Well, if he says, okay, you can't search my car, then that could be relevant on that point. But to use it as substantive evidence that he knew about contraband in the vehicle, and I did specifically narrow that issue down with the judge. There were about two or three points in the transcript where we kind of addressed that issue, and the assignment of error, I believe it's perfectly preserved, it's squarely on point, but there were different sort of areas of the conversation about why, you know, I thought it shouldn't come in, and then it did get squarely addressed that the Commonwealth is trying to introduce those statements in order to say that my client knew about contraband in the vehicle.
And just to be clear, which specific statement? Because why am I arrested is not a, I mean, what statement? What is the statement?
I would say there was three, and there were statements such as, you can't search me, you can't search my car. And I think why am I being arrested is a person trying to say, you know, you can't detain me, you don't have reason to detain me.
Well, that's a question, though, not a statement.
Right. Well, I think it's a statement with a clear purpose behind it, or a question with a clear purpose behind it, which is essentially to say, you know, why are you arresting me is somebody.
It's not an assertion of a right.
I would say when we look at the totality of the statements that were made, how they were made, this is a very fluid situation. I think we can say that in that context, it does become a statement of, hey, I don't know what's going on here. You can't search me. You can't search my car. Why are you arresting me? This doesn't make any sense. And, you know, that doesn't make any sense wasn't specifically said, but I think in that context, it's very clear that it was an assertion of that constitutional right. And ultimately, it was used at trial against him.
Well, let's take the statement, you can't search my car.
Yes, Your Honor.
While ownership of a car or possession of a car is not sufficient to establish possession of any item that's found within the car, isn't it a stepping stone and an order of proof to establish that? Isn't that a circumstance that can be considered? And so his acknowledgement that it is his car does I mean, you've challenged the sufficiency of the evidence that the gun in the car was shown to be in his possession. Well, isn't step one in the Commonwealth's chain of proof that it was, in fact, his car?
Well, it was framed as a sort of probative, prejudicial balancing test under 2403. So in that sense, they have him partway in the car, partway out of the car. They say he's doing something. We don't know what. It looks like he's rummaging in the center console. So to say you can't search my car, it's basically, I mean, he has to be able to assert you can't search that car. Okay, why can't you search that car? That's the car I'm asserting, you know, some...
No, I understand your point that he's claiming to the officers he has standing to assert that no one may search the car. But the fact that there is simultaneously, in fact, in this appeal, a challenge to the sufficiency that he possessed the gun, why isn't the fact that it is his car at least probative of whether he is... exercise dominion and control over the objects in the car? It may not be sufficient, but why doesn't it move the ball a little bit?
I guess I would say that when we look at the probative prejudicial, the analysis, the probative value of it is essentially to say, hey, he just asserted a right, it's constitutional right. And I understand going beyond the standing aspect.
You can see that it's at least somewhat probative of the ultimate issue of whether he's exercised dominion and control over... whether it's possible that he exercised dominion control over objects in the car. It's his car.
I would say a negligible. There could be some little tiny, tiny bit of probative value to it. But when we weigh that against, you know, this guy's now getting penalized for asserting a constitutional right, I think that the prejudicial value of punishing for that is clearly greater than the probative value. The probative value, I would have to concede there's a tiny bit there, and the reason would be he could say, you know, I was just walking past the car. That car's got nothing to do with me. And he could have testified at trial and said something like that. So in the sense that there is some alternative hypothesis out there that...
it's my buddy's car.
Could have been.
I was a passenger. I was a hitchhiker.
And it is noteworthy that at trial he didn't testify, but the officer testified that the car wasn't registered to him.
That makes it even more probative, doesn't it?
Well, it wasn't registered to him, but you can still assert, you can still say you can't search my car, even if you don't technically own the car.
But as to the question of how do you prove that it's his car, and therefore...
or that he had dominion and control over the car.
Of the vehicle, I mean, I don't even think that would be at issue, so that's why I'm saying the probative value would be very minimal or negligible. And the reason is because these officers see him at the car, and unless he's about to try to steal the car or there's some other theory of it, I mean, I don't really see the probative value to say that he knew of contraband in a center console or in a different compartment. I do understand the argument that the marijuana has a smell to it and that there's a distinction with the gun, which doesn't have a smell to it. But still...
And you're challenging the sufficiency.
Right, and I just... kind of...
you're a good lawyer. You're challenging. You're challenging all things.
It's the first time I've heard that. I appreciate it, but
no, I think we've told you once or twice before.
Not even a mom.
My mom was a prosecutor. She
still thinks you're a good lawyer.
She's very ashamed. She's very ashamed of me. I go back and forth with the. I'm trying to like balance both of these things because they are kind of intertwined. This other assignment of errors. There's essentially, we got this Burchette case, and that's one of those few cases that defense attorneys love because it kind of lays out, you know, you can be highly, highly suspicious. You can have documents in there. You could have recently occupied it, and there can be a bag of marijuana sitting right there in the console, and unless there's something else going on, it's not going to be enough.
It's on top and your hand was in the console?
Well, that's another thing. I did put an analogy. I'm not sure what your honors think of it, but it was the one where a guy goes upstairs to borrow a friend's shirt, opens a drawer, rummaging in there, sees a gun, says, oh, no, it's a gun, finds a shirt that fits him and closes it. That would be factually no different than this based on what the evidence is. We have an officer who's connected this guy to the car, my client to the car, for no more than, say, a few seconds. I mean, I passed by, smelled marijuana, other officer came by, checked it out. Guy removes himself from the vehicle immediately and shuts the door and starts walking away.
There was nobody else around the car, though.
There wasn't. But they don't have him driving the car. They don't have him...
but they got a statement that it's his.
They do have that statement. And that's a statement that I'm hoping doesn't get considered. Because I still don't think that it's probative as to knowledge of contraband in a console. And looking at...
but it doesn't go to at least diminish? We now know it's no longer... going up to your buddy's room and rummaging through his drawer looking for a shirt.
Well, what I would say...
It's my, at least the drawer has been entrusted to me for some period of time.
An unknown very short period of time, as far as the record's concerned, I would say. But I would also say that his actions, being right there in front of a 7-Eleven in broad daylight, with the door open, doing something, we don't know what. I mean, what would the reasonable theory be? That he's trying to grab the gun and run up in there and rob the place? Is he looking for change? That's a much more reasonable theory, I would say.
That he's seen a police car and is trying to hide the gun?
That's not a theory that doesn't have a strong basis to it. But at the same time, we look at Burchett, we got to exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. And that's why that case, to me, is so valuable. Burchett also does have the language about these statements and whether they should be considered. It strongly, strongly hints that my argument's a very good one. It just wasn't really squarely before the court in Burchett. So I think that if this court follows that line of reasoning, take the statements out of the equation, you're left with, I would say, not enough evidence. Even if you brought the statements in, I still think there's not enough evidence. But if you take those statements out, it's kind of fishing. Okay, well, the marijuana has a smell, and he was proximate to the marijuana. Okay, well,
even if we agree with you on the statement, the sufficiency analysis, we have to consider the statement by statute, don't we?
Yes, I would say that the statement was... allowing the statement in was not harmless error under the facts, and the reason being that the remaining evidence was not sufficient as it is. I mean, I also have to argue that even if the statement came in, still not sufficient. Finally, I know I'm going, can I cut into my rebuttal times very quickly?
It's up here, yes.
Yeah, all right, so Pruitt is that case for the concealed weapon charge. They don't see him with the gun. Nobody ever has the gun on him. Pruitt, car accident happens, gun's in the console, guy gets out, not proximate to it, not on or about his person, accessible for prompt and immediate use for any appreciable length of time. Based on the record here, a couple seconds, he could have had the gun in plain view and then moved it to the console. I know I'm kind of having it both ways, but there are just reasonable hypotheses of innocence all over the place. So for that reason, I'd ask for that charge also to be.
And how many of those did you argue below?
How many of those?
Of those reasonable hypotheses of innocence were argued below in the trial court?
There were a few. I'm sure
a bunch of them. That's okay.
I'll look it up. On
no, a bunch of them. They were.
Yes. Thank you, Ron.
Ms. Tyson?
Good morning. May I please the court? I'd like to address the sufficiency of the evidence first and then go, unless the court would prefer to do it the other way. A reasonable hypothesis that was given to the trial judge that was rejected was that he was looking for change in the console. And so that's a factual finding. The trial court rejected that that suggestion or that hypothesis of innocence. We want to talk about the Pruitt case. This case is far different, far distinguishable from Pruitt, and that's why Pruitt is not controlling. In the Pruitt case, there was the automobile accident. The driver put the gun in the console, left the car, closed the door. In this case, the initial attention was drawn to this car by Officer Parrish because of the strong odor of marijuana. He saw the defendant rummaging, rifling, whatever word you want to use, in the console. He goes and tells his partner, who is Officer Bennett, there's a really strong smell of marijuana over this car. They drive the police car closer. Bennett gets out of the police car and approaches, and he is continuing to rifle or rummage through that console. So this is not the situation as in Pruitt, where someone puts the gun in the console, closes it, leaves, and closes the door. This is someone who is continuing to have contact with the console. And, of course, we know later, when the search is done, that the gun is lying right on top of everything else on the console. So this is Pruitt does not control this case because the facts are so different. The concealment was in the console. The fact that the weapon was readily accessible to the defendant is enhanced by the fact that he's continuing to have contact with the very console where the gun is located. And the question of whether the gun is or the weapon is on the person and available for prompt use is largely a question of fact under the Leith case. And so in this case, the court convicted of that offense, of the concealed weapon offense, and so that conviction should be affirmed. And it should be affirmed.
Ms. Tyson?
Yes, sir.
Is it the Commonwealth's position, although Leith on its own facts is effectively been overruled by the statutory exception. Because the statutory exception doesn't apply here, Leith controls and governs.
I think that the statutory exception was conceded that it did not apply here.
Right. And so given that, the logic and reasoning of Leith is essentially reinstated.
I think that the logic is, with regard to this fact, since this is a factual question, and Leith, the key to the console was on the same ring as the ignition key, and that was found to be sufficient. So in answer to your question, I would say yes, that the reasoning behind Leith, both that these are factual questions and that this sort of scenario and proximity is sufficient, would still be good, still be good law.
What about Burkett?
Yes. Well, in Burkett, or whichever it is, that's a very different case as well. And the evidence there is that the defendant had two cars, and he left one car, and he was driving the other one. And the officers asked to be able to search the car that was at the driveway. And Mr. Burchett said, no, you can't do it, even though there were items in there that were very suspicious. And so there was that reasonable hypothesis that while he was driving one of his cars, someone else could have placed the drugs in the other car. He was not in the proximity of the car that had the contraband in it. He was he may have been the owner, but again, these are all factors to consider, and he wasn't in the proximity. He wasn't occupying the car that had the contraband, and he was not in that close proximity to the contraband. So that's exactly the facts that we do not have here. And I understand the argument that at trial the Commonwealth must rebut those hypotheses of innocence, but that's a very different case from this one. And frankly, it's very different with regard to the statement as well, and I might as well talk about that now. The difference with Burkett is that this was a situation where the police asked for permission to consent to search, and that consent was denied. And that is not the situation that we have here. No one asked questions of the defendant in this case, and no one said, the officers didn't say, may we search your car, and he refused. That would be the Burkett or Burchett situation. Here, these were voluntary statements that he chose to make in response to nothing that the officers did. I'll also point out, as I did in my brief, that the court did not address the issue in Burkett. They specifically said this issue, and we've got some interest in this issue, but it wasn't raised on appeal. So the issue with regard to the statement, there certainly are cases that hold that a refusal to consent to a search can't be used as substantive evidence. I think we actually cited a federal case for that proposition. But Burkett is very different, both as to the sufficiency issue and as to the statement issue.
If the question had been asked, may we search the car, and the answer had been in the negative, but using the same words that were used, could any part of that statement be used as substantive evidence?
Because I didn't track down all of the research with regard to that, I'm not sure that it would be inadmissible, given that this isn't a custodial situation, that and even though the court expressed some concern about this in Burkett, I don't really know that any portion of you can't search my car wouldn't be able to come in, because at that point, obviously, if the facts were just right, Your Honor, then no. If this was a custodial situation and there was interrogation and there was no Miranda, I mean, you can imagine all of the permutations that could arise. But the situation here, just a blanket, you can't search my car. Why are you doing this? You can't do this. Why am I under arrest? That sort of statement was just made out in they're his own statements. They were used against him, and there was not a constitutional problem with those statements. Returning to the sufficiency on the marijuana, because I think that's the one really I haven't addressed. This was not just a smell of marijuana around a car. Both Officer Parrish and Bennett described this as a strong odor of marijuana. When Officer Bennett approached the car, the defendant, who had the car door open and was fishing through the console, got out of the car, closed the door, and then on page 97 of the appendix, denied that there was a marijuana smell. Well, both of these officers had described that as a strong smell, and it was coming from that gray Honda, and they moved their police car, they made the approach. And I think Irvin from this court certainly stands for the proposition of the importance of a very strong smell, a particular smell, a unique smell to a particular drug. There was this very strong smell. And
not much marijuana was found, though.
That's true. And not much was remaining in the car. There's no evidence as to whether there had been more, there had been less. And, of course, the testimony was that it was unburnt marijuana was the smell. That was from both of the officers. There was close proximity. The location of that marijuana was in a place where your ashtray would be, as I recall the testimony in the dashboard. And, of course, he was occupying the space of the driver, not sitting in the seat, but his knees were on the seat. And that was the driver's seat. And so the gun, as we've already discussed, is right there on top in the console where his hands are seen. And his body is blocking the view of the officers. I think that's clear from the record. But at least one of the officers saw that his hand or arm was in that console. And then the marijuana is close by as well. So we've got the proximity. And while, yes, the ownership or occupancy of the vehicle is not sufficient, it is a factor for consideration. And so when you combine that with his effort to close the door, deny there's a smell of marijuana, attempt to flee the scene, and the other antics that kept the officers from making their investigation, it is similar to Bolden in that fact, in that regard, where the driver gets out of the car in Bolden and tries to attract the attention away from the car where all the contraband is located.
If the statements were suppressed, would the evidence be sufficient?
Yes, it would. The evidence would be sufficient because the statements provide an additional connection to the car. The statements provide an additional indication of the knowledge of what's in that car. And that's why they're relevant, and that's why they are probative, and it was not error to include them. However, even without those statements, Your Honor, he exercised that dominion and control. And his actions, even without his words of closing the door and actually the denial of the marijuana there, I don't believe there was an objection to that, and his actions of attempting to get away and not following the instructions, and all of those things together, I believe that the evidence still would be sufficient. Of course, under 19.2.324.1, we're going to consider that statement. And as far as the probative and the prejudice, well, clearly to be relevant it's going to be prejudicial to the other side. And the two cases we cited on brief, I think, that are really instructive here are Landeck and Turner, and maybe Landeck more than any, because certainly there is prejudice that attaches to inappropriate comments and racial epithets. And yet, in order to show the malice involved in the crime there, the evidence, while prejudicial, the probative did outweigh the prejudicial. So we have relevant evidence, statement of the defendant himself. He made that statement not in response to any request to search or any request or any question at all from the officers. And as was noted here, although the resisting arrest charge eventually was dismissed by the court at the time the statement was introduced into evidence, that resisting charge was still on the table. And one of the certainly this is relevant evidence to that charge in how the defendant interacted with the police during the encounter that they had.
And so, your point is once it comes in, it comes, it comes in for any purpose.
It is. And, you know, actually the trial judge in this case did note, because there was some back and forth with regard to the reasons why the statement should or should not come in, that the Commonwealth could use this to connect him to the car. I believe the defense counsel argued that it didn't really connect him to the car, and the judge said, well, the Commonwealth may want to argue that. And, in fact, they did, and I believe that that is a legitimate use for that particular statement. So we would urge this court to affirm, based on the reasons that we've presented today and the reasons in our brief, and unless there are other questions, we would ask for that relief.
Thank you very much. Any rebuttal?
Just to point out, on page 114 of the joint appendix, the compartment with the marijuana was closed, so I think that's worth pointing out. The Commonwealth argued in their brief that it was harmless error because it was a bench trial, not a jury trial. I know Ms. Tyson touched on it briefly, where she said that the judge could, I guess, essentially admit that evidence in for a limited purpose, and maybe he did that type argument. I have to disagree with that fairly strongly, because when we look at the record, the judge made it clear that he found the evidence relevant, and that's in 77 to 78 of the joint appendix. And then, like I had said previously, the back and forth became narrowed to whether the invocation of Fourth Amendment rights can be used against a defendant to prove he had knowledge of contraband in the car. Judge stated specifically, the Commonwealth is allowed to argue that. They argued that. So I know that the opposing counsel cited a case where it's basically, you know, it's maybe more important that we have these limiting instructions in a jury trial, but in a bench trial, a judge can sort of parse the probative from prejudicial and make a determination. It's clearly clear on the record that he is admitting it for this very purpose that I've said is should not be admitted for. So that does give some pause for concern about, well, how did he make his final determination about what my client was doing in the center console? He did specifically say, I don't know what he was doing in the center console, but based on the circumstances, I'm going to find him guilty. And I think part of those circumstances would be those statements that he clearly finds relevant. So additionally, there were no fingerprints on any of the items. There was no DNA tested. It was clearly somebody else's car. And we sort of get to the consent we sort of get in a scenario with these statements where, you know, an officer could just come up to me and say, hey, I want to search you. And I say, no, you can't search me. Ooh, that's suspicious. Why won't you let me search you? Now I'm going to search you. And that becomes a problem. And we look at the Griffin versus...
Well, we've got a little more than that here, don't we?
We do. We do have a little more than that here, but it's not by much. I mean, it's not this guy's just hanging out and they come up to him. And I get that. That clear. That I just, I'm throwing out the extreme example to sort of illustrate the point. But I do think that's still applicable to my client. And the Griffin versus California case, you can't use it against someone that they invoke their right to remain silent. You have to, if you want counsel, you got to unambiguously and unequivocally make that known. I mean, you have to assert your constitutional rights. And if we're not letting people do that, then it's a massive problem. Then suddenly, not to sound like hyperbolic, but it. The whole system falls apart. I mean, I think this is a very, very, very important issue. It was clearly used to my client's detriment to find him guilty.
If he hadn't said anything, if he had just been silent, and the officers did not have reasonable justification to search the car, could you still win a motion to suppress?
I think I could win on the facts, the sufficiency of the evidence. Suppress? You're talking about...
Hypothetical.
Officers coming up to the car.
Exact same situation, except assume for a moment the officers do not have the smell of a marijuana. They don't have all the indicia that gives rise to the search of the vehicle.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And he says nothing. Wouldn't you be able to suppress what's in the car? I mean...
Yeah, if he's just hanging out, possibly rummaging for change...
Unlike, I want an attorney, I don't have to assert the right, my Fourth Amendment right, to have its protection. I can't give it away. I can't say you may search.
Well, I hear you. But
I can be silent and still enjoy the Fourth Amendment's protection.
I would respectfully disagree with that, and the reason being that it's acquiescence. He was quiet. I asked him, can I do it? He kind of looked sheepishly at the ground. There was a shoulder shrug. There was an eyebrow raise. Suddenly any little thing can become, you know, and that just illustrates the point. The best way to do it is to tell him, you can't search me. And he asserted the right. And that's just human communication. That's got to be the number one way to do it. And that's what should not ever be chilled in any sense.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel and then take up the case of Champion versus the Commonwealth. All right.